You're listening to Bondi Tunes International, broadcasting around the world, and we welcome our listeners on FM in Australia and New Zealand. I'm Henry in Sydney. How you doing? And we welcome two of our North America correspondents at the proverbial table, if you like. Ronan Seagrave is in Winnipeg, as I like to call it, the Peg, in Canada, and Thomas Booker in San Antonio de Bayard in Texas. Yee-haw!
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yes, that's because of the pollen in the air. I get it. We will talk about, you know, the 39th president of the United States, Jimmy Carter, who's in palliative care at home, having left a hospital. He was in the hospital a number of times. He's got a broken hip and bleeding on the brain at the moment. But first I want to talk, well, let me ask you this. Now, if you have cable TV, no matter where in the world you are, you will most definitely have CNN. You may watch CNN, and if you do, you will be aware, probably, of Don Lemon. Don Lemon joined CNN in 2006 as a correspondent and later achieved prominence as the presenter of Don Lemon Tonight from 2014 to 2022, following Chris Cuomo, who was no longer with the network. That's another story. Don Lemon is currently a co-host of CNN This Morning alongside Caitlin Collins and Poppy Harlow. Don Lemon is in trouble over six words. Nikki Haley isn't in her prime. What do you reckon, guys?
Far as I'm concerned, Nikki Haley's expiration date was a long time ago, but I won't go there. I'm not all that in it. I mean, there are complications about her that we can. But yes, the Lemon did botch it, and that's one thing that people have to learn is, especially on the media, that's heavily watched like that, politically correct and all that, that you just don't blab, like I just did about Nikki Haley.
Yeah. Ronan, do you think people are being a bit harsh about this?
I think you've got to put it in context. He made those remarks, used those words about Nikki Haley not being in her prime with two female co-presenters. Hardly positive. I think the other thing about Don Lemon is he comes across as kind of insufferably kind of smug and full of himself and full of his own self-importance. And his nightly show had just turned into a sort of two-hour
rant.
Trump. Yeah, rant. I mean, okay, I don't like Donald Trump, but I was kind of getting sick of just CNN presenters not talking about anything else. And that became a bit tiresome. And I think that was being shown in declining ratings. Now they've moved him to this morning show. So there was cause, including, we believe, from CNN employees for his removal. But they've opted which he is apparently doing some training, which one would assume is around language he should use and language he should not use, and he is apparently going back on air tomorrow. But you know, CNN is going through; it has financial pressures. It's had something of a shakeup, which the Don Lemon change is one of that. They're believed to be desperate to sign another comedian to do a late night show. Names like John Stewart and
Trevor Noah. I love Trevor Noah. He's rocks.
Yeah, but it's supposed to be a news channel, and they're trying to bring in comedy.
Yeah, I agree. But you know what, guys? This is because the late night talk show hosts are the news for younger people who don't watch the news. They watch the comedians doing probably a better job in some respects. Would you agree, Ronan?
I think that's very true in terms of monologues from people like Stephen Colbert in particular. I think it's also a response as such to Fox News, who have, I think his name is Gottfried or something, but they have this comedian, absolutely of a right-wing, extreme conservative persuasion, doing a sort of late-night show, and it's actually been doing sort of reasonably well in the ratings. So the kind of thinking in CNN is to kind of put on a slightly more sort of centre-left counterpart to
that's
that.
Gilbert Gottfried, is that the guy who does the quack?
Yeah, if you like your comedy full of sort of tasteless racist and sexist jokes, he's the one to go for. But I think that's the thinking. You know, a Jon Stewart or a Trevor Noah would pull in, you know, viewers in that late night slot and maybe pull back some viewers who are going to the other late night shows.
It is worth mentioning that Trevor Noah has left the Comedy Channel. Is that what it's called that he was
correct,
on?
Correct. Yes.
So he's out there now. Yeah.
Yeah, he was last.
The Daily Show is right.
Yeah. Hmm. Sorry, Ronan.
No, he was last doing the Grammys, which he did very well, but he's certainly available. There apparently have been ongoing discussions with Jon Stewart, but we don't have any sort of sign whether those are reaching a positive conclusion or even Jon Stewart is sort of willing to do this.
I just want to mention that we're talking about she was former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley is actually put her hand up to go for the nomination for presidency of the United States. And this is part and parcel of you know, how Don Lemon, what he said, this is part and parcel of how dramatic this has become. In fact, he is on tonight. I watch CNN's morning show at 11 o'clock at night here in Sydney, Australia. And he is coming back tonight, my time, morning your time, as you said, Ronan. Now, let's talk about CNN as against Fox News. Fox News are still the number one cable channel in America, which reflects the American views on things. A lot of people love Fox News. CNN seem to be having one problem after the next. What can they do apart from hiring comedians, you know?
Yeah, CNN also has Bill Maher's after show.
They've now that's included new, their, yes. Their lineup. Yes.
Yes. So it's the little chat they have after his shows, a real time overtime. And as a matter of fact, the first time he was on, he forgot and he
said the F words.
Yeah, he said.
I saw that.
But anyway, yeah, I sent you a history of the cable, the evolution of cable news.
Yes, I wanted you to talk about that, Thomas, because it was very interesting to read.
I witnessed it.
Oh, you were there, man.
Yeah, I was there sitting on my sofa watching this all happen. But yeah, it was Ted Turner started the network. First thing he did was he put his local TV station on. He invented the superstation. So he had the Turner broadcasting system. And he started that out by broadcasting a lineup that had all the oldies from the 50s and 60s, even the 40s. And that was kind of got to be a hit when people started watching all the old TV shows and all. But then later on, he came along and developed CNN as a 24-hour news network. And that was on its trembling legs as it was trying to become established on the network. And then there was the incident that they had in, I think it was in near Atlanta, where they dropped a socket wrench in a missile silo and ruptured the tanks on a Titan II missile, and it blew up. And all of a sudden, there was a 24-hour coverage because everybody was afraid that an atomic bomb was getting ready to go off.
Wow!
But suddenly that established it, that event, and then more. Then later on, they moved on up to covering the Tiananmen Square protests.
1989.
They did all night programming covering the Twin Towers attack, they were basically establishing themselves as an event-driven overnight news service. And then on the heels of that, oddly enough, Bill Gates at Microsoft got an idea, so he established he made a partnership with NBC, and they started their cable news network of MSNBC. Which was actually home to Geraldo Rivera for a while.
Crazy man.
That was after the Al Capone thing. I think Al Capone thing might have been during it, for all I know. But anyway, it's just I'm saying that the impact of the cable media and the impact of 24-hour news caused a great revision on the culture of the news consumers. And that also drove the network news to have to... and this is where I think the Don Lemon problem comes in. They began to have newsreaders themselves They tried to have opinions, but they also had to be personalities. Mm. And they had to look good and look pretty. And nowadays, they have a couple of news anchors who, whenever there's a disaster anywhere in the world, they leave their anchor desk and they show up at the disaster scene wearing perfectly coiffed hair and tight T-shirts. Mm. And I walk around looking empathic.
It's interesting because, you know, as a person who was a newsreader for nearly 10 years, you know, the newsroom on radio or television, I was on radio, was seen as a loss leader. That's the term used when you're not making any money in this part of the radio station or television mm-hmm. station. So what they've done is, Ronan, they've dumbed down the news and put a lot of funny, you know, content in there to make it not a loss leader. Ronan, you and I grew up in Ireland, talking of CNN, which I do believe started in 1985. Yep. No one had CNN in their homes. I don't know about America. They probably did, but not in Ireland. But I was working on a radio station called Radio Nova, and we had CNN, which was just amazing because no one had it at home. The owner of Nova just made things happen. Ronan, do you recall this?
No, I do remember that in Nova about the Challenger disaster, and
yeah,
I think for
I
me,
broke
then,
the news. Actually, I broke the news on Nova.
Wow. On air with, and you know that showed, you know, its impact in terms of having reporters there and be able to get that footage on live. I think my other memory of it kind of really having a breakthrough was the first sort of Iraq war, you know, the invasion of Kuwait.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
91, 92.
You had Bernard Shaw and a couple of others in a hotel room, you know, breathlessly giving coverage and using satellite phones. And that really kind of, you broke it into, I thought, greater public prominence. You had James Earl Jones, who they brought back.
Yes, did the voice.
Yeah, this is CNN, you know, and...
Was that his voice? I never knew that.
Yes. Yeah, wow. He's the voice at CNN. Yeah, he was done for a number of years. They brought him back. But the other thing, I agree with Thomas. I mean, it kept very personality-driven. I mean, Anderson Cooper has probably become the kind of face of the station doing his show in the evening. And
what about
Wolf
Blitzer? What's going on with
him? Wolf is still there. You've got Anderson Cooper was the man sent straight to Ukraine when the invasion started. And he's become, I mean, I think he's actually a really good journalist, but he's become sort of the face of the station. But it does seem to be going through some kind of existential crisis right now and trying to sort of figure out what is it. Is it a serious kind of the old days headline news type station and dealing with a lot of factual reporting, or is it a more personality driven? I think Fox News's model is pretty straightforward. During the day, it's actually pretty much a straightforward news channel. Mm. It's giving news. I mean, they used to have Shepard Smith there for a while.
Yes, yes.
You know, has he left? He went off to the left, centre-left station.
He's left there now. I don't know what he's doing now. But it was kind of... And then in the evening, you know, you get to sort of 6, 7 o'clock and suddenly, you know, you've got Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham doing their shouting and roaring. CNN, is it that or does it... You have a much more rigid split around doing the news during the day, and then have more personality stuff at night, or does it go back to being a straightforward news channel?
Yes, it's interesting because here in Australia, you know, they've got Sky News in the UK, obviously. It's not nearly as right wing, very strange in Australia, and very similar to what you're saying with Fox News. Come dusk, you got all the lunatics coming on air, just like preachers telling you what they think and that what you should think.
Sean Hannity, Laura Ingraham, you know, all one after another. You know?
We've got an Australian version of that. I want to just mention CNN back in the first Iraq war. I think they were trying to attack Kuwait, if I can remember correctly.
Yeah, well, they were trying to liberate Kuwait.
I was talking about Iraq trying to attack Kuwait. Yeah.
Yes.
An interesting thing that I remember at the time, and correct me if I'm wrong about this, but I think this was this war in 1992. There were a bunch of CNN television reporters pretending to be over there. And do you guys know about this?
But they're in
they were in an acting studio somewhere in Los Angeles, and they had trees behind them, and they were caught eating, I think on the phone, or eating a sandwich or something. Oh, no, they got McDonald's.
Surely not
for Bernard Shaw, but
yeah.
But I was just amazed, and they got caught out. And, you know, it's you know, it's right up there with that guy on MSNBC who pretended he was in a plane or a helicopter. Yeah, what's his name?
Brian Williams.
Brian Williams.
Yeah. Oh, yes, that's NBC. Yes, he was actually the anchor. Brian Williams was the anchor on NBC.
Yes, he was.
And he got nailed for that. You know, was replaced by Lester Holt, which was a. Mm. And I also might want to mention that. I just forgot his name. One of the other anchors. He's now on a. He's on NBC. I think he's on MSNBC. Anderson Cooper. Sorry, Anderson Cooper is another one of those who shows up at disaster scenes wearing a real tight T-shirt.
Yeah, I think Ronan was just mentioning him.
Yes. That's right. Ronan brought that to mind. That he's one of the ones who. And they managed to. Project empathy really well on the scene.
Well, Anderson is never off the TV. He's also one of the presenters of
60 Minutes.
That's the 60 Minutes. So he's on there, Henry, in the Sunday night, you know, earning a few more dollars for that one.
Well, he's got a child to bring up, as far as I know. Or is it two? I don't know.
Something like that. Yeah.
With his boyfriend. Yes, okay. Well, you know, I just wonder where CNN's going with this. And I'm also wondering where Don Lemon, is going. And, where, you know, I'll be interested to watch him nervously between the two girls on CNN's morning show.
Yeah, well, I wonder if this is his third strike and he's out because he's costing... He's probably had other stumbles. But.
Of course, he used to follow Chris Cuomo, and they would have this five-minute love-in as the show crossed from Chris to Don. And the media is reporting that, you know, Don and Chris don't speak anymore because Chris Cuomo, well, you know, got kicked off CNN unceremoniously. Mm-hmm. And they live very close to each other. Don would go to Chris Cuomo's house and have barbecues with Chris's kids and his wife and all that sort of stuff. I wonder, really, I mean, I've been in the broadcasting industry for 30 years. Whatever the hell the media says, really, you still go for a drink in the pub. You know, back in the pirate days in Dublin, Ronan, you may remember, we would all go to a pub called the Henry Grattan in Dublin. And we were all, it was three stations, sorry, I'm just going off on a bit of a rant here. But anyway, I was on Nova, those people on Q102, the three big stations, Sunshine Radio, we all competed ferociously against each other. But then on Friday night, we'd all get together and have a chat. And that was it.
Yeah, exactly. That worked. Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm just going to take a break and we'll be back in a minute.
Women in the courtyard, children on their knees. Everybody knows them, no one is looking for me. Robbers on the highway, beggars in the street. Everyone is lonely, no one is trying to be. Make way for the kings of the world. Make way for the king. Yes, they still are. They still are here.
This is Bondi Tunes International Broadcasting around the world, and I welcome our listeners on FM in Australia and New Zealand, and I have our North America correspondents, Ronan Seagrave in Winnipeg, Canada, and Thomas Booker in San Antonio de Bayar in Texas.
And speaking of which...
Oh!
There you go, Harry.
Thank you.
Oh, that'll get you going.
A beer. Oh, God, it's so hot.
I don't have to wait until Friday.
Oh, hang on, it's just arrived. Fantastic. Thank you so much. 2.5 seconds, a bit delayed this week.
Yeah, it is. I'm having lots of problems.
Okay, now we really must talk about Jimmy Carter. He's in palliative care at home, having left, some people say the hospital, some people say the hospice. I'm not sure, but he's been there. And he's gone home. He has a broken hip and bleeding on the brain. The guy is 98. Comes to mind, the Watergate scandal was a major political scandal in the United States involving President Richard Nixon, 1972 to 1974, that led to Nixon's resignation. By 1977, until January 81, he took over Richard Nixon. He was the 39th President of the United States. My God, he's 98 years old, guys. You know, we do wish him well.
Don't forget, he followed Gerald Ford. Gerald Ford inherited after Nixon was...
I was wondering what that gap was.
That was it, yes. Ah. He actually ran against Gerald Ford.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Okay.
Yeah.
Hmm. Well, what do we reckon? I'd like to talk about, you know, what he's achieved. You know, when he took over from Ford, there was an oil crisis around the world, really, and he took mm-hmm. that on, you know, when he became president, when he did. Like, that must have been a huge thing to take on, because that was global. I remember I was in boarding school in Limerick in Ireland, for goodness sake, and we felt the pain of petrol at the pump. What do you reckon, Ronan? We will talk about, you know, what he's done in his time as president. Who wants to start this? Ronan?
Yeah, I think he was president, Henry. I think the first thing you would say that he was important in that he helped bring stability and credibility back in the office of the presidency after the Nixon resignation. Gerald Ford hadn't been elected by anybody, and he was an important figure in terms of sort of restoring confidence in American democracy and the presidency after that fairly traumatic episode. It has to be said, Henry, he was a man besieged by problems and crises, mm-hmm. the inflation crisis, the energy crisis, and then ultimately the one that proved to be, I think, also a factor in his defeat, the Iran hostage crisis,
mm-hmm.
the
Iranian
revolution and the Ayatollah Khomeini and the prisoners held hostage by the Iranians under the American embassy. And however... leaving aside all of those crises, he also had a number of achievements. I mean, I remember as a child watching the Camp David agreement that he brokered between Israel and Egypt, and Mahakam Begin and Anwar Sadat shaking hands and smiling at each other, and Anwar Sadat turning up in Jerusalem. So he was an important figure in bringing those two countries together, and who had been at war several times over the previous two decades together and signing a peace agreement. He was also perhaps unfortunate, Henry, in his timing. If he had been, say, dealing with Mikhail Gorbachev in the Soviet Union, perhaps things would have turned out differently. He was stuck with the Cold War and Leonid Brezhnev and not really any kind of movement other than a lot of saber rattling and trying to get sort of nuclear arms treaties in place. But he was sort of overwhelmed, Henry, by all these problems and issues. And it created a feeling of malaise in America that the country was sort of in despair. And along came the smiling Californian, former actor Ronald Reagan.
Yes,
it's
indeed.
Morning in America, everybody. And Reagan, won very easily against Carter in 1980, which meant he was just a one-term president.
And it is worth mentioning that you talked about the leader of the USSR as it was, Gorbachev, and Reagan going up to Reykjavik in Iceland and forming a deal that basically effectively shut down the Iron Curtain, and of course later in 1989 the Berlin Wall. I mean, did Reagan deserve all the glory for that, or did his predecessor
That's a very complex question. I think you could argue that at the time, while it was very controversial with Reagan embarking on a massive increase in defense spending, what it did, though, was, Henry, it forced the Soviets to try and keep up with that degree of spending on
Star Wars.
And they couldn't, Henry. They didn't have the resources or the money to keep up with that. And you can argue that arguably brought the USSR to its knees and forced change and forced Gorbachev and some perestroika and glasnost, and the place had to be modern.
It is fair to say that Gorbachev was not extreme like his predecessors.
No, indeed not.
And this is where Putin comes into this. He thought, well, bugger him or any of those who are, I'm going for the old-fashioned thing. Let's get the USSR happening again. Really, that seems like that to me. Thomas, in America at the time, did you feel, you're in Texas, which, let's say, is a center-right, or is center too close?
No, Texas was right when I'm...
Yes, it still is, isn't it?
But
how do they take it? Like, how do they take all this stuff that was going on, especially with the president at the time?
Well, being in media, you know, so we know what the initial appearances and how events and personalities can be distorted. And Jimmy Carter was right off the bat pretty much a victim of media. And for one thing, he started out, he's had the Southern accent. He had the was a peanut farmer, and he had a ne'er-do-well brother, and
Billy.
Yeah, Billy Beer and all that.
What happened to him? Do explain.
Oh, he was just an alcoholic, and I think he died later after Carter's reign, but no, he was
basically drunk himself to death, Thomas.
From alcohol and drugs, but this is long after Carter, you know, had left. But Carter himself, he was a nuclear engineer. He was a commander of a nuclear submarine in the Navy. He knew Hyman Rickover personally, who was the person who created the entire nuclear submarine force. And the man had creds. The man had intellect. He tried bringing in the engineering, an engineering perspective into the White House. He was one of the one who established, retrofitted all the offices in the White House with word processors.
Wow. Which
was a big deal. That was a big
deal. Yeah.
And he also, one of the other things he tried to support was to convert the United States of America to the SI unit, System International, otherwise known as the metric system. He got huge blowback for that. It was outrage. But what he was trying to do at the time was part of the economic woes the United States was having was that we were having a huge trade deficit with Germany and with Japan. Because Japan was suddenly creating high-quality cars that were fuel-efficient, and we were in the middle of a oil crisis. And also Germany came through with their brands of cars, and diesel sedans and things like that. And so Carter was trying to set the standard so the United States industries could start conforming to the SI unit so they would be able to sell goods that met the standards of Europe and Japan and then the rest of the world, the rest of the planet. And for that, he was just pilloried. I mean, and I remember our right-wing radio station, we had an AM radio station here in San Antonio, Texas, and the guy would get on his noon show and just start rant and rave about the peanut farmer and this guy, this damnable.
They're kind of like the shock jock of the day,
Yeah. And then, so also the other thing that was, so Carter apparently he was technically competent. He was a good manager. He had all the other skills that you didn't see, but his outreach was not that good. And it was right in the middle when they were having the recession, and he'd taken over from Gerald Ford, and Gerald Ford had been, of course, he had the whip inflation now buttons that were pathetic because we had a big inflation thing and a trade deficit, as I mentioned. And so Carter, on the advice of some idiot, his communications expert in his White House, decided he would do a fireside chat. And that was a disaster because he showed up as Franklin Delano Roosevelt during the Great Depression had a weekly show that he would get on. It would be called the Fireside Chat, where he would Roosevelt would spell out carefully and meticulously all the policy decisions he's making and all the progress that's being made and the changes they had to make. And it was very articulate. It was a very successful media campaign for radio at that time. Mm. So Carter tried to duplicate that by having a fireplace and sitting in an easy
chair. Fireplace chat, yeah.
It was a fireplace chat, and he had a fireside chat.
Fireside chat, sorry.
His cardigan sweater in a comfy lounge, and he would try to talk to, and he was just about the United States in a malaise. And
did people buy into that, Thomas?
No, they were outraged by it.
Oh, well, is that right? Sorry, you did say that.
They thought it was condescending. They thought it was silly.
It sure was.
and it was awkward. But once again, Carter didn't have the talent for communication. There was that problem. And then later on, before Russia fell, then we had the Three Mile Island catastrophe. Mm. And yes. Carter happened to be a nuclear engineer from the Navy, so he was familiar with nuclear reactors. He went out in person to visit Three Mile Island shortly after.
Wow.
And the signatures, once again, this is another visual, but there's Jimmy Carter and Rosalind there in the control room, and everybody in the control room, they had to prevent the possibility of picking up radioactive debris on their shoes and footwear, so they all had to wear a yellow galoshes to walk around. And this is the real catastrophe. to this day, I still think about it, and it cracks me up, and I watched it when it actually happened. A long story short, I went on a date, and we went to see the China Syndrome. And then that evening, we went back to her house, and her parents were there, and they were watching Saturday Night Live. And Saturday Night Live did a takeoff on the and they called it the Pepsi Syndrome. And I've been trying to find it. I can find almost every one of their other sketches that they did on Saturday Night Live. But the China Syndrome was just, yeah. And I had just seen the China Syndrome, and they did the Pepsi Syndrome. And the whole joke of it was he went down to the reactor depth and came back and said, "There's water down that reactor. You need to get someone to mop it up." And at that time, Garrett Morris was there, and Garrett Morris was doing this absolutely perfect rendition of a black maid. And so they sent Garrett Morris, Garrett Morris's character, down with a bucket and a mop to mop up. But at the end of it, the end of the skit, it turns out that Jimmy Carter became the amazing colossal president. And it was a riff on an old 50s science fiction movie.
Yeah, just to let our listeners know, the China Syndrome, what a great movie that was. Yes, and the fantastic Jack Lemmon, along with Michael, a very young Michael Douglas, a slightly older Jack Lemmon, and just a very sexy Jane Fonda, but she's a brilliant actor, I must say.
How did you like Jane Fonda's job doing a TV reporter? Because that's another thing that they were taking off of was the
Happy Meal. Yeah, it was interesting.
It really was well done.
It was appropriate for the time, you know, the way she did this. And she was hardcore. And that is kind of almost unusual for the time, a woman doing that stuff, you know.
So that was, and then after that, the Iranian hostage crisis was the big disaster that you couldn't recover from. And I have personal memories of, I was in San Antonio when, and this is the thing that really has me infuriated with him, and the fact that he elected to bring the Shah of Iran to Texas, to an Air Force hospital, Wilford Hall in San Antonio, Texas. And he personally went there and visited and was at the bedside of the Shah. And that action caused at the time, Iran was being overthrown. The Ayatollah came in and took charge. And the students, alleged students, the radical Islamics or whatever you want to call them, took over the embassy and was holding the hostages. As a result of that, that precipitated that event. And after that, and then the plan to rescue the hostages was the most appalling thing I've ever heard of in my life. And it was going to be, it would have been a disaster. It was a disaster, actually, because it didn't get fully implemented. They haven't acted in the desert, and it killed a bunch of men. But originally, they're going to try to land in the desert and then drive into Tehran on a bus and go to the embassy and shoot
none
the
of it,
terrorists.
None of it. it's any sense.
Oh no, it's insane. And as a result of that, I mean, Jimmy Carter's administration completely unraveled after that. It was, you know, it was a disaster. And Reagan won. And I don't want to go into Ronald Reagan and his because I haven't had enough beers to talk about.
Okay, now we're just going to take a break and come back with the Guinea worm disease. If you have just joined us, I'm Henry for Bondi Tunes International in Sydney, Australia, and I'm joined here by our North America correspondents, Ronan Seagrave in Winnipeg, Canada, and Thomas Booker in San Antonio de Bear in Texas.
Yeah!
And we're talking about President Carter, who's 98 years old, and he has gone home for palliative care. And I just want to mention a couple of things. After leaving office, he remained engaged in political and social projects, receiving mm-hmm. the Nobel Peace Prize in 2002 for his humanitarian work.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Henry, he set up the Jimmy and Rosalind Carter Foundation and devoted, you know, a tremendous amount of time and energy into that, into a number of projects. Everyone's familiar with the footage of Jimmy Carter building houses for Habitat mm-hmm. for Humanity mm-hmm. in his hot weather. But he had a number of really important healthcare projects, one of which was essentially leading the eradication, or almost the eradication, of Guinea worm disease, which is a horrible kind of parasite.
Please explain that, because I've never heard of that before.
No, it's a horrible kind of parasite in water in Africa, that when it gets into sort of the internal systems and intestines of its unfortunate victims can lead to agonizing deaths. And he spearheaded a massive global effort to rid the world of this. I mean, at a conservative estimate, Henry, you could say that Jimmy Carter has saved probably up to 80 million lives, which is kind of astonishing.
That's something else.
And the other first start, yes.
He never sought any kind of glory around it, you know what I mean? Or, you know, standing up and saying, what a great man I am, I've achieved these things. It was done with his typical understated modesty. And but the Jimmy and Rosalind Carter Foundation, it has done just amazing work across the world. And I think he set a kind of a template or an example of how to be a really great former president, that there are things that you can do. We've had the Clinton Foundation, we've had efforts by other, the Obama's Foundation, but he really spearheaded.
And of course, after Trump left office, you know, all the stuff he's done. Just joking.
Indeed, and never shutting up. Jimmy Carter was not one for twittering or tweeting. He came across, I think, as he was. He's basically a good and decent man. Christian faith was extremely important to him, and even until his recent illnesses, he was still taking, Sunday Bible school with children and in his Baptist church. So, wasn't a president, you know. You're going to church and making a big song and dance. He really believed in that and led his life along with Rosalind in that particular way. And he'll be remembered for me. Yes, there were all the challenges and the things that went wrong when he was president, a couple of things that went right. Thomas was like a very bad kind of communication advisor. But post-presidency, his legacy is, from my opinion, quite frankly, freaking awesome. And he will deserve all of the eulogies when the sad moment will come when he passes, and all the praise. Yes. I think he had a beautiful tweet on Sunday when it was announced that, you know, President Carter was receiving palliative care. It was from the Secret Service, and Jimmy Carter has had Secret Service protection since 1976, so we're talking 47 years. And they said, you know, the tweet from the Secret Service was, "Rest easy, Mr. President, always by your side."
A beautiful thing. He's 98 years old. He's in palliative care, and I hope that he's comfortable and not in pain. We've got to go soon. I would like to congratulate you, Ronan Seagrave, on becoming a citizen of Canada.
Thank you.
I mean, I remember in 92 when I became a citizen of Australia, we had to do something with the Queen. You know, do something to the Queen in our office in the Rocks in Sydney. I don't know. We have to swear to the Queen. I don't know what the hell it was. We are a Commonwealth country just as you are. Now a Canadian citizen, Canada is a Commonwealth country. And you had to kind of do the thing with the King, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I mean, in these days with you know, the pandemic, it's all online. So it was an online ceremony. And
Really?
There were a number of parts to it. The first part was I had to, in front of my laptop with the camera, cut up my permanent resident card, because we no longer are one, so they want that destroyed.
Really?
You absolutely witnessed and filmed and destroyed. And then you joined on a Zoom call, and I was seat number 131. There was a kind of hilarious 10 minutes, and people had joined using their names rather than the seat numbers, and they had to sort all that out. And then there's the ceremony itself. I mean, it starts off with a sort of video of Canada, video Justin Trudeau saying welcome home. And then there's a judge online, and you recite the oath, which is very similar, Henry, I imagine, to the one you took. You know, I pledge allegiance to His Majesty King Charles III, King of Canada and His heirs, and so on and so on. And you repeat that line by line, and then I had to do it in French, which I just about got through.
You had to do it in French.
But this in Quebec,
a clear record even English is sufficient. But anyway, I did it in French, and then they congratulations, you're now a citizen of Canada, and then there's a playing of O Canada, the national anthem, which everybody was invited to join in. I have to say, Henry, it's a very unusual thing to do in your life. You're born in Ireland, and you're Irish, and you kind of think that's it, but to become a citizen, especially at my time of life in my 50s of another country, I found it actually highly emotional, to be perfectly honest.
Absolutely, yeah. Imagine. I mean, you know, Australia, you know, like Canada and America to a large extent to people living in the UK and Ireland and other parts of Europe and Northern Europe, it's like a big deal when you're going so far away, especially Australia. And it is emotional. I was much younger than you. I was only 30. Yeah, I was 30. And, you know, I don't know what you did because you did this online, which I don't understand why you had to do it online at this point in time. But
they haven't gone back to in person, unfortunately, yet, Henry. No, it's mandatory online still.
Good Lord. Anyway, what I did was probably not the thing you should do when you suddenly become an Australian citizen. I went to an Irish bar on the rocks in Sydney and got pissed with my girlfriend at 4 p.m, you know. What time of the day did you do this, Roland? Did you have a drink afterwards since you didn't?
It was at 1 o'clock central time in the afternoon. So right bang in the middle of the day. I mean, it took about, with all of the sort of faffing about with people signing in and getting their seat numbers, the whole thing took about 2.5 hours, and there's lots of waiting, and then the ceremony itself took about 50 minutes. So yes, we did have, myself and Lisa did have a drink afterwards. I'm currently waiting. I've got to check my mail tomorrow. Probably similar to you, Henry, the next part of the process is waiting for my certificate of citizenship.
Yes, which I've got that somewhere.
Equivalent of a birth certificate, and I use that then to apply for a Canadian passport, which I need to do pretty much immediately, because without a permanent residency card, I can't leave Canada. So I've got to get
that. That's important. Yeah. That is important.
I wouldn't have a problem with that.
What was noticeable, Henry, was you get to see the other people in the ceremony on video screens, and the majority of them were young families. There were actually, and quite movingly, there was a reference to it, some Ukrainian refugees who, you know, had come over in the early part of last year with the war, and now becoming Canadian citizens. A mixture of people, I think, really from all over the world. In fact, I was told that there were 37 countries with about, you know, I think 127 people being made citizens of 37 countries. So it was incredibly broad.
That is definitely a broad demographic, yes.
Yeah, and it was only people from either Manitoba or Saskatchewan. So when you think about it, it was just that those two prairie provinces where these folk were coming to. But I was just, the whole thing, Henry, took me about a year from the initial application to doing this, which I did last summer, this sort of online exam to a quiz, if you like,
when I came to Australia in 1989, you know, I came from London with my New Zealand wife, and I got into Australia as a citizen because my wife was from another country, New Zealand, go figure. But, you know, we had to do a lot of paperwork before we left London. Health checks, AIDS tests was important at the time, which would make sense, 89. Nice. And coming to Australia, it was a huge, big deal, and we were very lonely for a long time. You know, the thing is, you know, you have to be able to get out of the country, Ronan. So get that done as soon as possible. If you want to visit Ireland, and
yeah, I've got to get back. You could get to visit Ireland, and so I'll get moving on that pretty quickly. But you're right, Henry, in terms of, you know, when you first sort of emigrate, which is essentially what you're doing. You know, you move from one part of the world to another. Those first weeks, and indeed, you spend, and I look back and it are very difficult. I mean, you're lonely. Yes. You're the moments that you, because you don't know anybody.
We had no internet. We had no internet in 1989 when I came.
You know, the only people I knew I didn't know them, but just people I was working with, you know, and I didn't really know them, and I was trying to get to know them. But you don't really know anybody.
My wife at the time, Desiree, she was from New Zealand, as I mentioned. I met her in London, but she had never been to Australia. She's from Auckland, which is kind of weird. So we arrived in Australia, Perth. It was way too quiet. My job was posted to Perth, and I said, bugger this, it's too quiet after living in London for 3 years, and we flew to Sydney, and the rest is history. But, you know, we didn't, it cost a fortune to call our friends. In that case, in many cases, most of my friends were actually in London. And there was no internet, so we were very lonely because neither of us knew anyone in Australia. Yeah. And, you know, the first thing, Ronan, you know, what happened in the first year, I should say, is you get to a stage. We actually planned and had money saved up to fly back to London, which I find bizarre in my brain. But we were so homesick for our friends in London. But then we actually separated. Probably a lot of it was getting married too young and over these issues of the fact that I wanted to go back to London. Anyway, we never went back to London. And what I noticed, which was really intriguing, missing your friends for the first year, wherever you've come from, in your case, it was Britain as well, Ronan. Yes, and then something happens in about a year. Suddenly you've got these friends from work, or that gradually you're switching your old friends from, you know, the UK or whatever, and you're gradually building your friends in your case, Canada, my case, Australia. And it worked. I didn't want to go home anymore. You know?
Well, if you like some insight added to that, I have telegrams from my aunt who she married a guy and he was going to get rich in the oil biz in Australia somehow. But she sent back home, it was like 1955 or 56. And she sent back this, it would be hilarious, but it was this recounting of what life was like in Australia then. Mm. And she was just going on about what a backward, messed up country it is and how lazy it is.
And she what era was this, Thomas?
I think it was like it was around the time Australia hosted the Olympics back in I think it was 1956 or
56. Oh yes, it was in Melbourne, yeah.
It was about that time.
That was 1956 in Melbourne.
Yes, as a matter of fact, she did. She settled in Melbourne too. And then this is this girl from Dallas, Texas, and a good fine Christian girl she was.
Oh dear.
She was like that. And but the one thing that I love the most about it was just talking about how slow the people are doing the work they should be doing, and she's really tired of all these, you know, indolent communists that are
Oh my god!
But I mean, if she went through that, I can tell that she went through that through her writings, because once she got established, she wound up being divorced. She wound up alone, like you did, Henry. You were kind of abandoned.
Yeah.
And she established herself, and later she became went through college and got a degree and became a teacher and had kids and all that sort of thing. So
yeah. You do get into it eventually. Ronan, I was talking about loneliness, and also the person you're talking about, Thomas, being lonely, in her case, going to Australia. Ronan, you were with your then wife, I would imagine.
Yes.
Did you know people in Canada?
No, I didn't. We didn't know anybody in Canada. What happened with me was it was an opportunity through my work. I'd been with Dutch to say a large, one of the big four consulting companies in a healthcare practice, and I'd done some work to help set up the global part of it, and I did some work out in the Middle East, and they wanted me to go out there for a couple of years, and that didn't kind of work at the time, and they said, well, would you take a look at Canada? And they want somebody to come out from the UK to Canada for at least 3 years to help set up a consulting practice. And well, this was sort of came as a bolt from the blue to me, but I thought, Canada, yeah, I've never been to Canada, but I'll take a look at it. And you know, one thing led to another, and ended up talking to, you know, people in Vancouver and Toronto, and then ended up agreeing to go out. And I still remember, you know, lots of memories that you remember of those sort of early. I remember being on the plane, you know, you're getting on a plane and you realize it's a one-way ticket. You know, you're not a return.
Yeah, that is scary, isn't it? I did the same thing, except, you know, we went to Garuda Airlines because that's the Indonesian airline, and we're going to Bali, the beautiful island of Bali. And we smoked our way all the way from London to Hong Kong, and from Hong Kong to Bali. You know, you're allowed to smoke in the back of the plane. it just seems so unlikely now. But so anyway, Ronan, did you really have to sort of make this decision? Was it a difficult decision? Thinking that you're talking about not just 1 year, but more than 1 year, so far away in Canada, and what about your family and all that sort of thing?
Yeah, no, there was a lot of that, and I remember my father's still alive at 89, but I remember having a conversation with him, and he gave me some very wise advice. You know, if we go to Canada, it would be a long way from you and my mother and at your age. And he said, son, stop. He said, you cannot live your life through us. If you have the opportunity to build a new life, he said, if I was you, I'd be grabbing this opportunity with both hands. He said, you've got an opportunity to build a new life in an amazing country, and it's been given to you. Take it, and don't be worrying about us. And you cannot live your life through your parents. And it was incredibly
very wise words.
Wise advice to give, and I accepted that. And it was hard. You know, I remember various kind of leaving parties and the tears, and you know, you're saying goodbye to people, and you can't sort of dress it up anyway. Yes, you might see people in a year or so, but you couldn't dress it up that you weren't going to see some people for quite long periods of time.
Well, especially in Australia. I mean, you know, you couldn't afford to go back to the UK to see people at that age, at my age.
The cost of it, the cost of travel and everything else. Social media, I think for me, Henry, has probably made it a lot easier. You know, even 2013, obviously Facebook and everything else, that's made...
I have none of that.
Unbelievably, not having to worry about the cost of long distance phone calls.
That was our big problem.
It made an enormous difference.
It sort of makes you wonder, though, if King Charles is going to become known as the Zoom King.
King.
He's got his coronation coming up. He's still agonizing. Yeah. He's still agonizing with Harry and Meghan are going to turn up with an episode.
Yeah. they might over, like, they. The media might have more time, spend more time on them than the coronation itself.
I think that's the worry. Yep.
Okay, guys, we got to go. We're way over time, but that's okay. No rules on this radio show. Thank you so much to our North America correspondents, Ronan Seagrave in Winnipeg, Canada, and Thomas Booker in San Antonio de Bayar in Texas. Thank you both for joining me.
Do it again.
Take care.
Take care yourself, man.
This is Bond iTunes International. This is Real Radio.
Your good friend around the planet, Bond iTunes International.
Indeed, thanks to our correspondents, and thank you for joining us here on Bond iTunes International. My name's Henry. I live on Bondi Beach. We'll be back with all the correspondents next week. See ya.
I give her all my love, that's all I do. And if you saw my love, you'd love her too. I love her. She gives me everything and tenderly. My lover brings, she brings to me, and I love her. A love like ours could never die, as long as I have you near me. Bright are the stars shine, dark is the sky. I know this love of mine will never die, and I love her.
sun never sets on Bondi Tunes.